disgrace. Cigarette and body dressed in leather and lace. I heard you calling me. Due to my insanity, your blood's gonna be the death of me. Dead bride warming up on the stove.
Through the nauseous night I'll soar, I'll wade through pools of rancid gore. I'll slide through clumps where maggots squirm, I'll skin dive where piranhas churn. I'll tread the reeking, oozing swamp, through corpse-filled quicksand beds I'll stomp. Through vampire nests I'll wend my way, where werewolves dwell I'll pass today. I'll lift your coffin lid, my dear, my nose will tell me you're still there. I'll realize my lifelong dream to wish you happy Halloween.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Hey, this is Derek, and you listen to Skepticality, the official audio show of Skeptic Magazine, for Tuesday, October 25th, 2011. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of Skepticality, the show which brings you news, interviews with scientists and authors, and the movers and shakers of skeptical thought, promotion of reason and science. Since it is that time of year, it is getting chilly. Folks seem to be putting up decorations with ghosts and vampires and mutilating pumpkins on their front porch. I thought what a better time to bring on the guest I'll be talking to later on the show. But I'm just teasing you. Before that, you get to hear and be entertained by the ever-interesting Tim Farley and the Skeptic History for this episode.
It's time again for Skeptic History, I'm Tim Farley of whatstheharm.net and skeptools.com. This edition, we've got tidbits from the history of alternative medicine in the United States and some anti-vaccine activism that's older than you might think. The history of alternative medicine in the United States is a long and convoluted one. Of course, in the 18th and 19th century, before medicine itself was standardized or even very scientific, it would be difficult to make the distinction of what was medicine and what was alternative. Some of the modalities of that era got a leg up on their journey into the 20th century. Homeopathic medications were helped by the fact that Senator Royal S. Copeland of New York, born November 7, 1868, was also a homeopathic physician. When he became the sponsor and co-author of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, he ensured that all existing homeopathic medications were automatically granted pre-approval under the new drug regulations. Other modalities had to fight harder. Chiropractic battled for years to become licensed in all 50 states. On November 2, 1963, the American Medical Association created a Committee on Quackery with the expressed goal of eliminating chiropractic. This resulted in the Wilk antitrust lawsuit that the AMA eventually lost. And so the battle raged on until the 1970s. It was then that the New Age sparked interest in many unusual things, including alternative medicine. Interest in acupuncture in particular was increased by a 1971 article in the New York Times written by James Reston, who was born November 3, 1909. 2 decades later, interest in alternative medicine had made it a multi-billion-dollar industry. The November 4, 1991 issue of Time magazine even featured it on its cover. A few years later, an effort to amend the very same law created by Royal Copeland resulted in the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, enacted October 25, 1994. This law exempted most herbal supplements and vitamins from regulation and has been a thorn in the side of skeptics ever since. Opposition to vaccines is one of the top issues for skeptics these days. Many date current anti-vaccine efforts from Andrew Wakefield's infamous and now retracted 1998 study. But anti-vaccine sentiment is actually far older than that. In fact, let's talk about two different cases where anti-vaccine societies were founded over a century ago. In 1902, the town of Cambridge, Massachusetts was dealing with a smallpox outbreak. A mandatory vaccination law was enacted, but several citizens resisted and were fined. They sued, and the case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where it resulted in the landmark ruling in Jacobson v. Massachusetts. The court upheld the local law on the basis that the interests of public health outweighed the personal freedoms of those being vaccinated. Outrage over this and other vaccination laws resulted in the creation of the Anti-Vaccination League of America, sponsored by industrialist John Pitcairn Jr., at an anti-vaccine conference held October 19th through 21st, 1908. The group published anti-vaccine propaganda for several years. A more dramatic reaction to vaccination took place in Brazil around the same time. After Rodrigo Alves took office as president of that country November 15, 1902, he made it a goal to get rampant infectious diseases under control. Various urban renewal programs were undertaken to improve public health. Finally, on October 31, 1904, a mandatory vaccination law was passed and health workers prepared to fan out and administer smallpox vaccinations. Various false rumors immediately began spreading about what these workers would be doing. A League Against Mandatory Vaccination was created on November 5, 1904. But it didn't stop there. On November 10th, open armed resistance began in what is now known as the Vaccine Revolt. The fighting raged for almost a week, and by the time it was put down on November 16, 1904, there were 30 dead and 110 wounded. A far cry from the online rantings of current anti-vaccine campaigners, And all of this took place half a century before Andrew Wakefield was even born. That's it for this visit to Skeptic History. As always, links to additional material will be provided in the show notes. For more Skeptic History, check out JREF's free app for iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch called Today in Skeptic History. You can also follow me on Twitter or Facebook under the name Krelnik, K-R-E-L-N-I-K, where I post a new Skeptic History fact every day.
Thanks again, Tim. So, it is that time of year again where we are somehow close to the world of the dead. At least, that is what some people say. Since ghosts and ghouls are what part of the traditional fare this time of year, I thought what a better time to bring on our guest from this week. David Daigle works at the CDC and was also the person who came up with a highly successful preparedness outreach campaign using zombies. I got to sit down with Mr. Daigle and talk about what zombies have to do with the CDC, and also a little bit more about what role the CDC plays in the United States and around the world. So, you are involved with the zombie patrol for the CDC.
That's right. There are really three government communicators and Dr. Kahn, who's our director, who are, I guess, the nucleus of the zombie task force.
That's what you call it, the zombie task force?
We did, and still do, I think.
And what are you exactly involved with at the CDC?
I am, my day job is the associate director for communications, and we divide CDC up into centers and offices, and, you know, based on, you can have, I guess, sometimes it's based on a bug, or and some examples are birth defects or chronic diseases or infectious diseases, and our center is called Public Health Preparedness and Response, and so I'm the director for communications in that center.
And so people have seen now and then, you guys have, like, posters, and I think I've seen a couple billboards with the whole zombie theme. Where'd that come from?
The zombie theme came from, there was a couple of us sitting around, though, I guess it was like late on a Friday afternoon, and this was about a month before the hurricane season began. And we were, somebody brought up that we're getting ready to launch the hurricane information campaign. And I said to myself and to the group, I said, you know, I think that we probably say pretty much the same things every year in the same way, and I just wonder how many people are paying attention. And this was after we'd had a really rough season before that with tornadoes and other things. So one of the ladies who runs social media mentioned that, you know, when we were tweeting on Japan, the subject of zombies seemed to come up in conjunction with the radiation. And that seemed to spur the conversation. And so I said out loud, zombie preparedness. That really sounds interesting. Maybe we should explore that. And I walked into Dr. Kahn's office, because late in the day, no one's ever around there. And I just said, you know, I think we're going to do something with zombie preparedness. I don't know what yet. And he said, you know, show me a concept. And we went to work, and we put something together in about 2 weeks. And we launched it right before the hurricane season went off.
Interesting. So actually, the whole idea didn't come from a disease, it came from hurricanes.
It was based on hurricanes, and we said to ourselves, you know, we knew that zombies were trendy, and I said, you know, if nothing else, we'll reach a different demographic or a different audience than we would normally reach with the hurricane warnings. Well, I think we'll engage a younger audience that might be interested in zombies, and the whole idea was, if you're prepared for zombie apocalypse, you're prepared for pretty much anything, whether it's a hurricane, tornado, or we call it all hazards. And we thought about how this would go. I said our plan was to do it in two phases. The first phase would be the blog, and then we would wait 2 days to see if anybody got fired or in trouble, and then we would launch the social media aspect of it. And that, because we were kind of going in a place that where we hadn't gone before, and that was to give a federal agency a sense of humor.
No, it didn't have anything to do with the fact that the AMC now films here in Atlanta with the zombies.
You know, it's so funny. I wish I could tell you I was real smart and I'd factored all this stuff in. And if you remember back, our campaign was launched the same week that they were predicting. I think that church organization was predicting the end of the world.
Yes.
I'm not that smart. I mean, that was a coincidence that could defeat our campaign. And I knew that AMC, and I'd watched some of the shows, and I knew that they had blown the CDC up. But I didn't make that tie initially about, you know, this will be a good reason to do this. For us, it was pretty much trying to do trying something different to engage a new audience with a message, an old message, really.
Where is the zombie campaign now? Are you in the second phase or third phase?
Well, that's very interesting, Derek. I mean, there are a couple of folks who said, now, this was very good. You guys trended. You did all this. It was amazing, the results you got. But, you know, how long can you ride this horse? Isn't it over? And, you know, and we didn't want to ride the horse too long. But I can tell you, it really hasn't ended. I mean, we are doing some things with AMC and Walking Dead. We are, you know, we had Dragon Con, which was fantastic. There was a whole, that's an audience that really, I thought Dr. Con was well received, and the fact that CDC was there was fantastic. A lot of people, so there seems to be a lot of interest. So we are doing a novella, a graphic novella around a zombie preparedness.
Wow.
And we're doing some. You've seen the posters, and now our CDC Foundation, which is a fundraising organization, is selling zombie task force T-shirts. And I mean, I haven't. My sense is that we also put posters up on the and. We can't keep them in stock, so there seems to be a great deal of interest still on zombies, and we're hoping to keep leveraging that interest to, you know, talk about preparedness and help people to think about getting a kit, making a plan, and being prepared.
Well, you know, it's coming up on Halloween, so.
Well, and you're right. Yeah, it's so funny. There's a big conference in D.C. that CDC participates in, and they came to us, and they're handing out zombie preparedness bags. So, I mean, you're right. Halloween's a perfect tie. And so, beyond Halloween, I guess we'll take a look and see where we go from next. But I can tell you right now, there's still a great deal of interest, and all the products, the few products that we do, are well received, and every time when we blog or do anything on it, people still seem very engaged and like the campaign.
So, have you ever thought about moving the zombie idea into some of the infectious disease campaigns as well?
We've had some other folks ask us, the CDC, you know, hey, should we do something with zombies? And you know, and so there has been some other interest too. So we'll kind of play that by ear.
Because I know there has been some other organizations in the past have used zombies as a model for infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
I forget exactly who they were, but I thought there might be some tie in there as well.
Well, you know, there's been, and Ollie's talked about this in a couple of his presentations about when the I Am Legend folks were here, they were talking to the rabies team a lot about that they were looking for a virus that was would create what they were looking for, and the rabies was a good model. And there are different, and rabies is a neurological virus, of course, and a lot of people speculate this would be a neurological virus. So there's been a lot of talk about different, you know, how a zombie outbreak would spread, and how would that really translate through modeling like other viruses would spread. So, yeah, there's been some pretty interesting discussions around that.
Yeah, we had a guest in the past who did some books on math, and they used zombies as a vector in the math problems for calculus.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, so I thought maybe the same idea could apply to modeling disease.
Yeah, no, it might well, and we do have a lot of folks who do model diseases around here.
Now, your part in the CDC, since I had you on about the zombies, but, you know, we kind of covered that a little bit, where your work at the CDC is exactly what?
I run a small communications team that runs all the communications for this office, Public Health Preparedness and Response. And so we would run the internet, the intranet, the public affairs or media relations involved. We would work on health campaigns or information campaigns. So and sometimes we deploy when we have teams out in the field that need communication support.
A lot of our listeners are international, so there's some people who might not live here in America. But the CDC does disease. They also do other things, not just disease. Can you expand on, like, what the CDC actually does?
Yeah, no, it's, you're exactly right. We're the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and prevention is a really and a lot of people tend to think of CDC as just the guys going out in the suits, you know, doing the epi or lab for an infectious disease outbreak. But we have a great deal of our time and effort spent on what we call chronic diseases and prevention. And so there are folks working very hard, everything from smoking cessation to all kinds of chronic conditions, injury, birth defects. So you're right. And then we're watching huge cholera and dengue outbreaks. Speaking when you talk about internationally, when sometimes we send teams out at the request of the country to work or assist these countries.
Where has the most focus been going on worldwide?
Well, we have, I think right now, I was just looking at the sheet of where we had folks deployed, but we have folks involved in, I think, Haiti's cholera outbreak. I don't know, there's a big cholera outbreak also in Nigeria, and I don't know if we have folks deployed there. I think they may just be talking those. But we have, as far as people permanently stationed, we're in 60 countries right now, and we have probably the largest, I guess the largest footprints would be in Kenya, Guatemala, Thailand, have pretty large CDC institutions right now.
Talking about a little bit closer to home, there's been a lot of talk, especially in the skeptic community, about things like the whooping cough epidemic. Has that been any of your focus?
Yes, in fact, we have a lot of folks who work on vaccination, and there's been whooping cough. You've also seen a huge spike in measles cases, which a lot of these diseases, most of us have not given it a thought to for some time. But we're seeing some countries where they don't vaccinate as aggressively as we do in the U.S. People visit those countries, and they bring whooping cough or measles, or and they spread it to, sometimes it's children who are not at the right age or who are unprotected and not vaccinated. And sometimes it happens in emergency rooms. And we've seen outbreaks, and you mentioned whooping cough, but also as well as measles. We see outbreaks of these or small outbreaks in different communities. And a lot of it's due to a failure to vaccinate or folks coming and introducing it to an unvaccinated community.
Now, we've had recently had another vaccine clinic at DragonCon, and we had one at TAM. And a lot of adults don't realize they have to get their boosters. How often do those boosters have to be given?
Well, it depends on and we have it all up on our website. If you have any question about whether it's whooping or measles, you're right. For each different vaccine, there's different age and time requirements. But and also, if you travel, sometimes some folks travel from the U.S. or from other countries, there are vaccinations or medicines that we suggest, and we have a travel page that if you're going to visit certain countries, you should either get this vaccination or consider taking these medicine along with you. So I would tell people you can easily get to all the vaccine or travel requirements off the main cdc.gov page or cdc.gov, and you can either get the vaccination schedules, or if you're traveling and you might need a vaccination, that'll be on there off that main page as well.
As far as things like the pertussis or the whooping cough, the same thing, I guess, all those boosters, how often should you get them? Is there any danger if you actually might have had one in the past, like a couple of years? Does that hurt you to get another booster shot?
No. I think what would hurt you is, and you'll, some of our folks, depending on the disease, if you miss a booster, you will still have some protection. Not the protection level that we would like, but if you've had the initial vaccination and you've had a couple of boosters, but you maybe there is some protection there, depending on different factors. But we encourage people to do the full course of vaccines and to get the boosters, because you really won't have full protection unless you follow the schedule.
Now, when you get your booster when you're an adult, is that like the last time you have to do it?
Depends. Sometimes there are some shots that I think you have to get almost annually. Obviously, a flu shot is an annual one because the virus, there's actually, you're getting protection for three different strains of flu every year, and we try to pick the most widely circulating strains. But rabies, I'm thinking of our folks who are vaccinated for rabies, I think they get an annual shot just to keep that level of protection up.
Those are people who have to deal with, like, animals or...
Yeah, exactly. We have folks who, depending on where you work at CDC, there are certain, you maintain certain inoculations, certain vaccinations.
Yeah, because that's rabies vaccine or something.
Oh, veterinarians do the same thing. I think a lot of those guys are maintained, or anybody who does animal care usually will maintain the rabies vaccine. And I believe it's and I'm not positive, I'd have to check, but it may be a yearly shot just to maintain.
And that's one of the things that people don't think about.
No. But if like I say, if you are curious and you wonder, or if you're traveling, I really encourage you to check the traveler's page and make sure you get the right vaccinations depending on what country you're going to.
When people see the CDC people out in the suits, those types of incidents, how often does that happen?
Gosh, I mean, it depends. On any given day, we may have several teams out, and usually let's take, for example, a team is, we get a call from a state or a local health department that has a different investigation or a unique situation, and they can call for CDC assistance, and sometimes they ask for lab support. In other words, they'll want to send us samples for our lab to analyze, or they'll ask for what we call EPI or epidemiology help, and that would be actual disease detectives So I would say at any given time, there are probably two or three teams deployed somewhere, either working with the state or local, or if it's another country, the host country's counterparts on some sort of investigation.
Now, those field groups, can they do their own lab work in the field?
Sometimes they can. There's what we call rapid diagnostic tests, but usually we'll try to get it back to CDC Atlanta, because we can really do some good, there's strong lab work that needs to be done with the facilities here in Atlanta.
So, of all of us, because I live here in the Atlanta area, as obviously you do too. A lot of people always come to me and say, "Well, the CDC is here, and they bring all the stuff here. Isn't that a danger? Because now,
right.
If something happens, is it going to kill everybody here in Atlanta?"
Well, and it's funny because you're right. There's a BSL, what we call BSL-4 lab right here on campus, and the BSL-4 is biocontainment safety level 4 is the most highest containment level. That's where you work on things like smallpox, Ebola. Either there's a high security or there's no cure or vaccine. And so I get the same question sometimes. Do you ever worry about being right next to a lab like that? And I point out that our child development center is right here on campus as well. So we all have our kids on campus. Well, many of us have kids on campus with us. But if you look at the labs and you look at what they can, how they're built, it's amazing. They can withstand. I mean, a very strong earthquake. They can withstand hurricanes and tornadoes. They are really built. It's amazing, not only how strongly they're built and how secure, but also the different, safeguards put in place. It's just incredible. So, I know it does seem a little scary that you're thinking about what might be going on in that lab. But then if you look at the safety precautions and how the buildings are built and designed, I think you feel much better about it.
Now, most of those labs are actually underground, too.
No, they're above ground. I mean, some of the lower levels may be down below the ground. You're right, yeah.
Yeah, because, most of the what's underground here in Atlanta is all granite, so that's pretty strong stuff.
You have to do some blasting, and you're right. For if you're an Atlanta guy, if you dig anywhere, sometimes it's a lot of blasting.
Like my backyard.
After you don't hit the granite, you hit that red clay, which can be just like granite.
What is now the big thing that you want everybody to know about?
Well, there are a lot of things going on, and some of the things, and you touched on this earlier, we talked about the chronic or preventable diseases. And so one of the things, because this is a really tough economic tie, one of the things that we've been working on is showing people how much money can be saved by doing very simple things like stopping smoking, by watching your blood pressure, all the things you can do that prevent chronic conditions or not get into trouble with your health. And so that's one of the things, simple things like wearing helmets and what are different things like that, and wearing seatbelts. So we have a lot of campaigns around different things like that that hopefully have people live healthier, safer lives. And so those are going on right now pretty aggressively. We just did something that just came out was the movie Contagion was just released this month. And so we had a lot of, I guess there was a lot of media interviews generated by Contagion, where we got questions of could this happen? How realistic was this movie? What did you think of Contagion? So that was something that, not long term, it was just based on the movie release, but we did do a lot around that. But Right now, you probably have heard about the cantaloupes, and we're working pretty, there's a pretty serious, actually one of the most dangerous outbreaks we've seen in some time with the cantaloupes, and so we're working with the FDA on that.
Remind people, what's wrong with the cantaloupes right now?
Oh, the cantaloupes are spreading listeria, which is a pretty, and it's, I think it was up to 13 deaths, and the company is in Colorado. They've recalled cantaloupes, but there's a great fear that, you know, some people may have bought a cantaloupe and put it in the refrigerator. And so we did a teleconference or telebriefing yesterday trying to warn people that if you don't know when in doubt, throw it out. If you don't know where the cantaloupe came from and you can't rule out that it came from Jensen in Colorado, please don't eat it. And then we just, I think there's, I forgot the number of cases. I've heard maybe 72 cases and 13 deaths, but it's very serious, of course. And this particular bacteria is very difficult on people who are immune compromised or older. So that's probably the big thing in the news right now.
So where can people ever find, does it have like some form of email alert system or a way that people can like go and see when these big announcements actually happen?
You know, you can always click on our website, cdc.gov, and there may be some alerts. I'm pretty sure, gosh, I think we have a pretty aggressive, in our emergency preparedness folks have a pretty aggressive social media, Facebook and Twitter as well. So we're also, you can sign up with our social media folks and get alerts that way.
Are you on Twitter?
I am not. We have it in the works right now. In fact, we're putting Dr. Khan and PHPR, the office I run, are both up. We applied for a Twitter account, and I hope to have them up and running very quickly.
Very interesting. Hopefully it'll happen before I put this episode out, and I can put it in the show notes.
It might. I'll keep you posted on that.
Very fun. Well, so much. Thank you so much for some of your time.
No, Derek, it's our pleasure, and thank you for your interest.
Oh, thank you so much. As you heard in the interview, the CDC does a lot of work to keep citizens safe, healthy, and prepared. There's a lot of information on the CDC website. Make sure you stick around to the end of this episode. I recently spoke with Richard Everest. He's working on a new project which he calls Schoolhouse Rock Meets Cosmos. The first video and song for the project is now up on YouTube for you to go and watch and listen to. I suggest you do. If they get enough interest, there'll be something far greater and bigger in the future. I got permission to play the very first song for the project, My Universe Revolves Around You, by Danny Keeger. Enjoy the song and make double sure to go and click on the link to the actual video itself. As always, you can find all the links and the things we discussed in this episode at our website, skepticality.com.
Girl, your mass is heavily attractive. I orbit you because my movements are reactive. I'm spherical, a miracle. The data is empirical. That finding you must have been a planetary miracle. I never seen a girl so fiery and gassy. My light in the darkness, don't my girl look classy. A lassie, a lady, she's got me feeling crazy. I'm spinning while I'm grinning on my axis, feeling lazy. The closer that I get to you, the faster that I start to move. Newton's law's gonna make it true. My universe revolves around you. At first I thought my trajectory was circular. One set point while my radius stayed fixed on her. But that all changed with Kepler's big discovery. He suggested I revolve with less consistency. My path elliptical in shape. Not like I wanna, but there's no way to escape. Why an oval? You may be asking, and it's right of you to question what I've told is true. The facts as I have tried to prove. Einstein gave the answer as to the path of the celestial dancer. What'd he say? He suggests it's the curvature of space-time. And he's a pretty smart guy. Let's just leave it there.
All right.
The closer that I get to you, the faster that I start to move. Kepler's law's gonna make it true. My universe revolves around you.
Oh, what was that? Did something come between? Are there other satellites that you might be seeing? I'm really hurt, girl. What have I been to you? I'm a solo system. There ain't room for two. That's it, baby. Now we're through. I hope you're supernova and take me out till you be a black hole. Honey, take me inside. Spit out the matter in a matter of time.
It was just one of my moons. Ooh. Eclipse in your light. Girl, I knew you were true.
The closer that I get to you, the faster that I start to move. Newton's law's gonna make it true. My universe revolves around you. The closer that I get to you, oh, the faster that
gotta stop to move. Kepler's law's gonna make it true. My universe revolves around you.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
This Halloween, do your trick-or-treating at WHFR. Just call 313-845-9676 or email whfr@hfcc.edu. On Halloween Day, say trick-or-treat for a grab bag full of goodies. This Halloween, email or call WHFR. The treats are on us.
So since I was here last, in 06, we discovered that global climate change is turning out to be a pretty serious issue, so we covered that fairly extensively in Skeptic Magazine. We investigate all kinds of scientific and quasi-scientific controversies. But it turns out we don't really have to worry about any of this because the world's going to end in 2012. Another update, you will recall, because I introduced you guys to the Quadro Tracker. It's a like a water dowsing device. It's just a hollow piece of plastic with an antenna that swivels around, and you walk around, and it points to things. Like if you're looking for marijuana in students' lockers, it'll like point right to somebody. Oh, sorry. this particular one that was given to me finds golf balls, especially if you're at a golf course and you check under enough bushes. Well, under the category of what's the harm of silly stuff like this, this device, the ADE-651, was sold to the Iraqi government for $40,000 a piece. It's just like this one, completely worthless, in which it allegedly worked by electrostatic magnetic ion attraction, which translates to pseudoscientific baloney, would be the nice word, in which you string together a bunch of words that sound good, but it does absolutely nothing. In this case, allowing at trespass points, allowing people to go through because your little tracker device said they were okay, actually cost lives. So there is a danger to pseudoscience and believing in this sort of thing. So what I want to talk about today is belief. I want to believe, and you do too. And in fact, I think my thesis here is that belief is the natural state of things. It is the default option. We just believe. We believe all sorts of things. Belief is natural. Disbelief, skepticism, science is not natural. It's more difficult. It's uncomfortable to not believe things. So like Fox Mulder on X-Files, who wants to believe in UFOs, well, we all do. And the reason for that is because we have a belief engine in our brains. Essentially, we are pattern-seeking primates. We connect the dots. A is connected to B, B is connected to C, and sometimes A really is connected to B. And that's called association learning. We find patterns. We make those connections. Whether it's Pavlov's dog here associating the sound of the bell with the food, and then he salivates to the sound of the bell, or whether it's a Skinnerian rat in which he's having an association between his behavior and a reward for it, and therefore he repeats the behavior. In fact, what Skinner discovered is that if you put a pigeon in a box like this and he has to press one of these two keys and he tries to figure out what the pattern is and you give him a little reward in the hopper box there, if you just randomly assign rewards such that there is no pattern, they will figure out any kind of pattern, and whatever they were doing just before they got the reward, they repeat that particular pattern. Sometimes it was even spinning around twice counterclockwise, once clockwise, and peck the key twice. And that's called superstition, and that, I'm afraid, we will always have with us. I call this process patternicity, that is, the tendency to find meaningful patterns in both meaningful and meaningless noise. When we do this process, we make two types of errors, a type one error or false positive. It's believing a pattern is real when it's not. Our second type of error is a false negative, a type two error, is not believing a pattern is real when it is. So let's do a thought experiment. You are a hominid 3 million years ago walking on the plains of Africa. Your name is Lucy, okay. And you hear a rustle in the grass. Is it a dangerous predator or is it just the wind? Your next decision could be the most important one of your life. Well, if you think that the rustle in the grass is a dangerous predator and it turns out it's just the wind, you've made an error in cognition. You made a type one error, a false positive. But no harm, you just move away, you're more cautious, you're more vigilant. On the other hand, if you believe that the rustle in the grass is just the wind and it turns out it's a dangerous predator, you're lunch. You've just won a Darwin Award. You've been taken out of the gene pool. Now, the problem here is that patternicities will occur whenever the cost of making a type one error is less than the cost of making a type two error. This is the only equation in the talk, by the way. We have a pattern detection problem that is assessing the difference between a type one and a type two error is highly problematic, especially in split-second life and death situations. So the default position is just believe all patterns are real. All rustles in the grass are dangerous predators and not just the wind. And so I think that we evolved. There was a natural selection for the propensity for our belief engines, our pattern-seeking brain processes to always find meaningful patterns and infuse them with these sort of predatory or intentional agencies that I'll come back to. So, for example, what do you see here? It's a horse head. That's right. It looks like a horse. Must be a horse. That's a pattern. And is it really a horse or is it more like a frog? See, our pattern detection device, which appears to be located in the anterior cingulate cortex, it's our little sort of detection device there, can be easily fooled, and this is the problem. For example, what do you see here? Yes, of course, it's a cow. Once I prime the brain, it's called cognitive priming, once I prime the brain to see it, it pops back out again, even without the pattern that I've imposed on it. And what do you see here? Some people see a Dalmatian dog. Yes, there it is. And there's the prime. So when I go back without the prime, your brain already has the model, so you can see it again. What do you see here? Planet Saturn. Yes, that's good. How about here? Just shout out anything you see. That's a good audience, Chris, because there's nothing in this. Well, allegedly, there's nothing. This is an experiment done by Jennifer Whitson at UT Austin on corporate environments and whether uncertain feelings of uncertainty and out of control makes people see illusory patterns. That is, almost everybody sees the planet Saturn. People that are put in a condition of feeling out of control are more likely to see something in this, which is allegedly patternless. In other words, the propensity to feel these or find these patterns goes up when there's a lack of control. For example, baseball players are notoriously superstitious when they're batting, but not so much when they're fielding. Because fielders are successful 90 to 95% of the time. The best batters fail 7 out of 10 times. So their superstitions, their patternicities, are all associated with feelings of lack of control and so forth. What do you see in this particular one here, in this field? Anybody see an object there? There actually is something here, but it's degraded. While you're thinking about that, this was an experiment done by Susan Blackmore, a psychologist in England, who showed subjects this degraded image and then ran a correlation between their scores on an ESP test, how much do they believe in the paranormal, supernatural, angels, and so forth. And those who scored high on the ESP scale tended to see, not only see more patterns in the degraded images, but incorrect patterns. Here is what you show subjects. The fish is degraded 20%, 50%, and then the one I showed you, 70%. A similar experiment was done by another British psychologist named Peter Breuger, who found significantly more patterns, meaningful patterns, were received perceived on the right hemisphere via the left visual field than the left hemisphere. So if you present subjects the images such that it's going to end up on the right hemisphere instead of the left, then they're more likely to see patterns than if you put it on the left hemisphere. Our right hemisphere appears to be where a lot of this patternicity occurs. So what we're trying to do is bore into the brain to see where all this happens. Breuger and his colleague Christine Moore gave subjects L-DOPA. L-DOPA is a drug, as you know, given for treating Parkinson's disease, which is related to a decrease in dopamine. L-DOPA increases dopamine. An increase in dopamine caused subjects to see more patterns than those that did not receive the dopamine. So dopamine appears to be the drug associated with patternicity. In fact, neuroleptic drugs that are used to eliminate psychotic behavior, things like paranoia, delusions, and hallucinations, these are patternicities. They're incorrect patterns. They're false positives. They're type 1 errors. And if you give them drugs that are dopamine antagonists, they go away. That is, you decrease the amount of dopamine, and their tendency to see patterns like that decreases. On the other hand, amphetamines like and cocaine are dopamine agonists. They increase the amount of dopamine. So you're more likely to be feel in a euphoric state, creativity, find more patterns. In fact, I saw Robin Williams recently talk about how he thought he was much funnier when he was doing cocaine when he had that issue than now. So perhaps more dopamine is related to more creativity. Dopamine, I think, changes our signal-to-noise ratio. That is, how accurate we are in finding patterns. If it's too low, you're more likely to make too many type 2 errors. You miss the real patterns. You don't want to be too skeptical. If you're too skeptical, you miss the really interesting good ideas. Just right, you're creative, and yet you don't fall for too much baloney. Too high, and maybe you see patterns everywhere. Every time somebody looks at you, you think people are staring at you, you think people are talking about you. And if you go too far on that, that's just simply labeled as madness. It's a distinction perhaps we might make between two Nobel laureates, Richard Feynman and John Nash. One sees maybe just the right number of patterns to win a Nobel Prize. The other one also, but maybe too many patterns, and we then call that schizophrenia. So the signal-to-noise ratio then presents us with a pattern detection problem. And of course, you all know exactly what this is, right? And what pattern do you see here? Again, I'm putting your anterior cingulate cortex to the test here, causing you conflicting pattern detections. You know, of course, this is via Uno shoes. These are sandals. Pretty sexy feet, I must say. Maybe a little Photoshopped. And of course, the ambiguous figures that seem to flip-flop back and forth. Turns out what you're thinking about a lot influences what you tend to see. And you see the lamp here, I know, because we have lights on here. Of course, thanks to the environmentalist movement, we're all sensitive to the plight of marine mammals. So what you see in this particular ambiguous figure is, of course, the dolphins, right? You see a dolphin here, and there's a dolphin. And there's a dolphin. This is a dolphin. That's a dolphin tail there, guys. If we can give you conflicting data, again, your ACC is going to be going into hyperdrive. If you look down here, it's fine. If you look up here, then you get conflicting data. And then we have to flip the image for you to see that it's a setup. The impossible crate illusion. It's easy to fool the brain in 2D. So you say, oh, come on, Shermer, anybody can do that in a Psych 101 text with an illusion like that. Well, here's the late, great Jerry Andrus's impossible crate illusion in 3D, in which Jerry is standing inside the impossible crate. And he was kind enough to post this and give us the reveal. Of course, camera angle is everything. The photographer is over there, and this board appears to overlap with this one and this one and that one and so on. But even when I take it away, the illusion is so powerful because of how our brains are wired to find those certain kinds of patterns. This is a fairly new one that throws us off because of the conflicting patterns of comparing this angle with that angle. In fact, it's the exact same picture side by side. So what you're doing is comparing that angle instead of with this one, but with that one, and so your brain is fooled. Yet again, your pattern detection devices are fooled. Faces are easy to see because we have an additional evolved facial recognition software in our temporal lobes. Here are some faces on the side of a rock. I'm actually not even sure if this might be Photoshop, but anyway, the point is still made. Which one of these looks odd to you? And a quick reaction, which one looks odd? The one on the left. Okay, I'll rotate it so it'll be the one on the right, and you are correct. fairly famous illusion that was first done with Margaret Thatcher. Now they trade up to politicians every time. Well, why is this happening? Well, we know exactly where it happens, in the temporal lobe, right across, sort of above your ear there, in a little structure called the fusiform gyrus. And there's two types of cells that do this, that record facial features, either globally or specifically. These large, rapid-firing cells first look at the general face, so you recognize Obama immediately. And then you notice something quite a little bit odd about the eyes and the mouth, especially when they're upside down. You're engaging that general facial recognition software there. Now, I said back in our little thought experiment, you're a hominid walking on the plains of Africa. Is it just the wind or a dangerous predator? What's the difference between those? Well, a wind is inanimate. A dangerous predator is an intentional agent. And I call this process agenticity. That is the tendency to infuse patterns with meaning, intention, and agency, often invisible beings from the top down. This is an idea that we got from a fellow TEDster here, Dan Dennett, who talked about it, taking the intentional stance. So it's a type of that expanded to explain, I think, a lot of different things. Souls, spirits, ghosts, gods, demons, angels, aliens, intelligent designers, government conspiracists, and all manner of invisible agents with power and intention are believed to haunt our world and control our lives. I think it's the basis of animism and polytheism and monotheism. It's the belief that aliens are somehow more advanced than us, more moral than us, and the narratives always are that they're coming here to save us and rescue us from on high. The intelligent designer is always portrayed as this super intelligent moral being that comes down to design life. Even the idea that government can rescue us, that's no longer the wave of the future, but that is, I think, a type of agenticity. The projecting somebody up there, big and powerful, will come rescue us. And this is also, I think, the basis of conspiracy theories. There's somebody hiding behind there, pulling the strings, whether it's the Illuminati or the Bilderbergers. But this is a pattern detection problem, isn't it? Some patterns are real and some are not. Was JFK assassinated by a conspiracy or by a lone assassin? Well, if you go there, there's people there on any given day, like when I went there here, showing me where the different shooters were. My favorite one was he was in the manhole, and he popped out at the last second, took that shot. But of course, Lincoln was assassinated by a conspiracy, so we can't just uniformly dismiss all patterns like that, because let's face it, some patterns are real. Some conspiracies really are true. Explains a lot, maybe. And 9/11 as a conspiracy theory. It is a conspiracy. We did a whole issue on it. 19 members of Al-Qaeda plotting to fly planes into buildings constitutes a conspiracy, but that's not what the 9/11 truthers think. They think it was an inside job by the Bush administration. Well, that's a whole nother lecture, but you know how we know that 9/11 was not orchestrated by the Bush administration? Because it worked. So we are natural-born dualists. Our agenticity process comes from the fact that we can enjoy movies like these because we can imagine an essence continuing on. We know that if you stimulate the temporal lobe,
Thank you.